On this week's show, the battle for building codes with Scott Reynolds from UpCodes. In this week's news, Amazon demands 5-day return to work. Is this a sign? And more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right. Nathan Wood, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, man, I am excited for this one. I'm ready to rock.
Yeah, ready to rock and roll for sure. This is one that we've been covering for a long time and excited to bring Scott on and talk about where things are right now. Scott, where are you coming to us from today?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll just mention longtime fan of the show. So good to be on. Yeah, thanks for having me on today. Calling in from Canada, so doing a little bit of traveling. We just had a team offsite in Austin and then spending a little bit of time with family up in Canada.
Well, and that's right, folks. His background is not a virtual background. It is for real. It's pretty awesome. That's what I said when we came on, was like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Well, it's fun being here. The weather is a little less than ideal, but awesome to be in Lake Country.
All right. So we are back and it is time to talk with Scott Reynolds, co-founder and CEO of UpCodes. Before we dive in, let people know a little bit about what UpCodes is right now, and then we'll kind of get to the history of how you got here.
Yeah, absolutely. So just as a 10,000-foot kind of look down and overview, we consolidate regulations and codes across the country. So those could be federal codes, state codes, city codes, things like building codes, plumbing codes, electrical codes, fire codes. Just gather those all up into one place, make it digital, make it accessible, make it searchable, and then just build a lot of tools. So we work with people like architects, engineers, GCs, trades, fire departments, planning departments, building departments, really anyone who's going to deal with the regulation and code world. We work with them and just make an easy to use online platform to make codes a little bit more friendly to use.
Yeah, I remember back to, it was James Benham that brought the article to us. It was like, did you guys see this? Have you seen what they're doing? Have you seen, you know, because it like Nathan can kind of empathize, working with and trying to build, one of the hardest things is the codes and the regulations and making sure you're building everything up to code. And it's all locked up. Talk a little bit about kind of the state of it and why you guys even went down that route.
This goes back all the way to when I was in university. So you think about academia, they teach you how to design architecture. My background's architecture, I should mention. It just seems like this really creative, fun process. But then you get out, join industry, your first job, lo and behold, you really don't know how to put a building together. And codes and regulations obviously coming into play, defining a lot of the parameters and constraints around these buildings. And so much of the job is learning through experience and on the job learning. And for me, one of those big hurdles was codes. And, you know, just getting, you know, into the first day and be like, I've literally never flipped through a building code in my life. And, you know, it's kind of embarrassing, but I think, you know, that's the way it goes for most of the industry. Mm-hmm. And it was that frustration and spending years trying to, you know, bang my head against the wall, trying to figure out what are the regulations, going to colleagues, seeing their experience working with codes. And then candidly, like I won't call any firms out here, but we were making mistakes on some of these projects, you know, as it goes. We had code consultants on board, but even then we're struggling through the code, just trying to find what's the most up-to-date code, interpret it and apply it to the project. And there just was no structured workflow to do that. Like you think about project management, you think about Procore, you think about all the tools Autodesk has providing structured, dedicated software for these workflows. When it came to codes and regulations, there was nothing. And that was really the genesis. Let's say, like, what can we do here? What can we build just to make this very painful part of our professional life a little bit easier?
That's awesome, because that is like the foundation for what UpCodes became. And you kind of led into your own. So you're educated as an architect, I take it?
Yeah. Yeah. So worked or studied here domestically in the US, worked abroad for a couple of years, based out of Hong Kong for a couple of years, and then back stateside working out in New York for a little bit.
All right. So what else? I mean, so you go through that process. How different is it working in Hong Kong versus, you know, then coming back here to the stateside and working? Is there a lot of difference? What was that process like for you?
You know, it's surprisingly similar, and I think by design. So a lot of the clients, and we were working primarily in mainland China, they were looking for Western influence design. And it was just, you know, a little bit of an alternative to some of the more local design aesthetics, just to get a little bit of a mix. So, you know, by design, we were actually bringing a lot of the expertise. First, I was working at Hassel, a firm out of Australia, and then KPF, you know, US firm. So a lot of the work is very similar, you know, obviously very different in scale and how fast those projects move and how big the budgets are in a lot of countries in Asia. So I say very similar. Maybe it's the budget and the pace of projects that was different. And also regulations, I should point out. I thought when I moved from the New York City, from the Hong Kong office to the New York City office, codes and regulations would get a lot easier. Written in English, I could, you know, didn't need a translation of them. I thought it'd be a lot easier. And lo and behold, it's a heck of a lot more difficult and more stringent here in the US.
That's crazy. I mean, just as you were talking, I was thinking about that, you know, architecture engineering really is kind of code first that gets you to your design that gets permitted and you get downstream. And then as you get to the contractors, it's like code is kind of last, right? Because the inspector comes in and makes sure the code is there. So you mentioned GCs and trades. I'm curious, like, what are the workflows? Like, how are GCs and trades interacting with upcodes?
Well, you know, the code process is so messy that in the GC side and the pre-construction phase when they're onboarding these projects, they actually do a lot of code research. So we do work with a lot of GCs in that pre-con phase, and you know they're doing a little bit of catch up. Not necessarily their job to catch some of these code mistakes, but you know they happen. Unfortunately, it gets through the architect, through plan review. It just highlights how difficult it is to get all these codes right. But a lot of GCs will catch that upstream in pre-con before, you know, breaking ground or pouring concrete. But like you said, you know, once construction has started, there is a little bit of code lookup, a little bit of work there. But unfortunately, you know, a lot does get through to the building inspector and how they catch it at the final phase, which is the worst place to catch a code mistake.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine, depending on the type of contract. I'll give a Middle East example, so I don't out anyone here in the US, but certainly I've heard that many times when contractors catch those code mistakes, if it's in their best favor to not disclose that information and wait until they win the job and then file the RFI that turns into the change order that turns into the cost, they actually end up making more money. Don't hate the player, hate the game, right? That's just part of the strategy. But like, I could definitely see how GCs, whatever, would want to have that quick access to codes to see, you know, what's ahead of them, you know, see what's not there, and then decide strategically, depending on the contract type, you know, whether or not to disclose that information or not.
Yeah. And it's interesting, and not to go down a rabbit hole, but when you think about design builds, for many reasons, very interesting, but one of them is your incentives are very aligned, especially from a code perspective. You are incredibly incentivized to catch those potential code mistakes upstream before they get into the build side. I think a lot of these friction points and inefficiencies come from different parties having slightly different incentives, exactly like you're pointing out. That is the output of misaligned incentives.
Yeah, and we see that way too often in the industry. But here's the interesting part, right? We covered you guys a long time ago. I mean, you guys have been out for a while, and I remember the hype, and I remember talking about it and thinking, gosh, this is going to go like wildfire. Because it's such a difficult piece, such a critical piece. Cause I mean, look, we're going to get into the entanglement of where things are, but I mean, the fact that we have strict building codes and strict codes in general is a good thing, right? In many respects, because the whole reason is to, you know, build safe, build accessibility, build with, you know, purpose. But you haven't really reached where I think you thought you would, because there's been some hurdles. And I'm going to be transparent. You've come up against a lot more friction from the code side than maybe most of us predicted. And I want to just get it out there and talk a little bit about the friction and the problems that you've experienced. Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the ConTech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@thecontechcrew.com to learn more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the pillars of the company is just free and open access to these codes and to the regulations. And we wanted to build this platform that anyone could come on board. They could read them. They could work with them. And then we, as a business, we would build workflows on top of that. And that would be kind of like the premium or the paid side. So things like project management or automation and education on top of that. But that free and open access to the codes is where we hit the most hurdles. And it was surprising to us that it had been litigated, you know, way before we came onto the scene and down in Texas. And the court there said, you know, these codes, when adopted, are the law. And you can't copyright the law. Like, everyone owns the law in a democracy, and they need access and understand what their legal and binding requirements are. So that was litigated all the way back in 2004. So when we entered the scene, I think it was 2000. I'm going to get my years mixed up. I think 2017 or so. This is a while after that. And when we started, you know, just putting codes out there, and anyone could go there and read and work with them, copy, paste, print, and you know, communicate with the owner or with the architect. We got our first lawsuit, I think in 2017. I mean, right after, like immediately after starting. Fast forward to today, I think we've had 6 in total. And that's us. You know, that's what we're doing. There's nonprofits who also put the code out there to help people access and read it. And they've got similar lawsuits as well. Now, they like systematically come in, you know, relentlessly. But the courts all around the country and all the different levels have kind of all come around and said the same thing. You just, when codes are adopted into law, they enter the public domain and everyone needs access to them. It is a little bit frustrating. We have to kind of rehash the same thing over and over. One of these cases went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And this is a literal quote, but they said, no one can own the law. That sounds very obvious, right? Like, yeah. Of course, but we do need them to say it. We do need the judges to say it. But yeah, that's like a very brief overview of the last, but for it was, us, it, like 8 years. Yeah.
It was jurisdictions that were, who's actually filing the lawsuit in most of these?
So it's the Standard Development Organizations or SDOs. So they publish the books. And they publish the books and make a lot of revenue from that to the tune of literally hundreds of millions of dollars. Now they're technically considered nonprofits. When you look at the tax filings, they look a whole lot more like a for-profit. So the CEOs often get over $1 million. I mean, our first plaintiff, ICC, I think the CEO makes $1.5 million, 10 times the national average of a nonprofit. So it's a lot of these existing publishers that are trying to exert copyright and kind of own the kind of bottleneck on the codes and who can read them, who can access them, and in what form.
When you start to unwind this, it gets really ugly. I don't even want to say controversial, because it's the law, and it seems weird that you have to say someone owns the law. But obviously, you know, they're trying to protect profits, but you're not actually trying to cut into those.
Right. The codes we put out there are free to view. Like, the things we charge money for is the advanced functionality built on top of that. And right. The interesting thing is the codes are actually written by volunteers. So these are industry professionals, government workers, donating their time to actually write the code and put proposals in there. The nonprofits are just convening the committees to do that. But despite that, they gather up and they put that into a book and sell it right back to those same volunteers that just volunteered their time to actually write the code. So it is a very, very bizarre kind of part of the legal system we have here in the US.
Because that's the way that they've always done it. And I mean, you are explaining, case in point, innovator's dilemma, right? Of a new disruptive technology, you know, that wants to essentially change the value proposition around, you shouldn't be selling the information, you should be selling the value of the workflows around the information that by law is free.
Exactly. And we've seen so much stagnation in the regulation and code space in construction. I mean, it's barely moved for 20, 30, 30 years. Like we've been doing the same thing, binding up books and selling books. And you could look at other professions. So if you look at lawyers, they have so many tools they can put in their tool belt and they can choose from a lot of different options to help them parse through the laws and automate a lot of that process. So take out the very tedious kind of error prone workflows with dedicated software or otherwise solutions. But I mean, you look at construction and you know it's barren. Like there's so little innovation there. And I think what makes us very frustrated is that so many people, companies or individuals have reached out to us and said, hey, we had an idea. We wanted to create this code calculator or this workflow or this software for the code, but we were A, scared to do it because we were afraid we're going to get sued, or they did start and they got a cease and desist or the the lawyers on the other side would come down on them and threaten them and they would close up shop. So it's frustrating to think how many tools the profession would have at this point if that had never happened going back 10 or 20 years.
Yeah. But that, I mean, that's the nature of being an innovative, disruptive product, right? So you're going to have incumbent parties that don't want to see you succeed. I'm hearing zero-sum game, right, Jeff?
Well, no, but to me, this is a little bit different than that because this is sort of profiting off the rules and regulations and the law. And that's so different than like an incumbent type of system preventing other systems from coming along and disrupting them, trying to do what they can to position their way around them. Because you would think you made it to the Supreme Court, right? And no one can own the law. We got that. So end of story, right? You guys are innovating and moving from here.
And just to clarify there, it was a nonprofit that went to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
We've gone up to appeals, but we would love to get our own cases there just to, typically when you get the Supreme Court to say it once, it's good for everybody, but they can just bring in different districts. So we would love to get one of ours to that point. And I'll just quickly point out, Jeff, just before we switch over, with that revenue that they're trying to protect, it's actually, for many of the publishers, it's not even that significant a piece of the revenue. So you look at ICC, again, our first plaintiff, 88% of the revenue comes from non-book sales related revenue. So that's things like program services or training or material certification. So it's a very diversified business and in a good way. Binding up the books gives you a unique position to these other services. And they certainly do. And that's, I think, partially why they make so much money. But they often make the argument, hey, like we need a lot of revenue to continue operations. Well, it's like, 88% of that revenue is not coming from selling the law.
So you're not challenging that portion, but you would think with the court cases and kind of the history here that maybe you were reaching a tipping point, but I'm getting at they've actually tried now and are going to try to circumvent this and go a different route. So talk a little bit about where we are today.
Yeah, exactly. So here you have like a mountain of case law for all these courts across the country and going all the way up the stream saying you can't copyright the law. Now, a lot of what the publishers have been working on is going through proposing a bill. So the Pro Codes Act. And the Pro Codes Act, what they're attempting to do with that is, I mean, just like you said, like go around the legal system that they've now kind of failed at for so many years, and that get legislature to say they can have copyright and they can control access to the law. Now, this is a very new thing for us, right? We've, unfortunately, we became very well-versed in the legal system, didn't intend to, but did. And then now I've had to jump into the lobbying side. And we're seeing the millions of dollars they've spent to try and get traction and influence these individual politicians in DC to push the bill through. So, our focus has changed a little bit. So now we're playing defense on another frontier, which is on the legislative side.
Well, and this is why I love geeking out on this stuff, because I mean, you guys are basically doing the action items all the way up to the Washington D.C. stuff that with Construction Progress Coalition, everything we want to try and get going with things way further downstream of like what are some of these payments activities and other RFIs and other transactions that are the kind of breadcrumbs of really good project analytics and forecasting and other things like that. but you need these real pulls of, you know, what is this, you know, law or thing that we can kind of hang our hat on. And that's, I love this example of codes, and figuring out, like, as contractors, what can we learn from these efforts, and even take value from these efforts that are, you know, hopefully going to make the downstream acceptance of, you know, digital designs and digital things that meet those codes, so that we don't have to go looking in the same areas. It's just linked right there. You know, I assume you're kind of thinking about that whole workflow of how do we connect the dots between those that are designing and those that are building.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the codes and regulations are the foundational layer for so many of these workflows. I mean, so just like you're mentioning, things like permitting or, you know, even like project management or getting into plan review or looking at schedules, so many things get tied back to the code. Mm-hmm. And when you start to, I think, lock down that foundational layer, you lose the opportunity to inject that into so many of these downstream workflows. So I think as we start to open it up more and more, I think it has very, you know, positive benefits to that, and all the way into the contracting onto to the build side.
Well, and that's where, as much as I hate bringing up the AI conversation again, it's like that I feel like is where all those different dots, that's like, who knows the correlations and the causations that are out there. But if we just put those feelers out and just let the data be open, it'll bring some interesting stuff back, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think where the industry sees a lot of friction is how much information is in silos. And AI, I think, does its best when it can traverse and see a lot of data and bring in really interesting insights. But when you have these products or data sources that are so siloed and don't speak to each other, you can't get that broad kind of AI application. And, you know, kind of on that topic, like we've kind of jumped in headfirst into the AI space because it was such a good application for AI. We have over 6 million sections of code of, you know, building codes, electrical codes on the site. 7,000 on average get updated every single month. So like, how do you like have a system that can traverse a sprawling range of code? And this is that's just the code side, you know, and using AI to bring insights to that. But yeah, when you combine that with like project data, with permit data, or as built, you know, I think it queues itself up to be a really powerful system.
But we're not going to get there if this actually happens, that the Pro Codes Act actually gets past. So you're and you know, lobbying is a very big business in Congress and in our government. It's huge. I mean, there's lobbies from everywhere, and it's not hundreds of thousands, it's millions of dollars. And they're looking to grant this private ownership basically around the fact that we've already decided in our courts that you can't. So what's that front like? Because we're not going to get all these other great things that Nathan's talking about and that we want to geek out on if this actually happens.
Yeah. And I think the frustrating part is the amount of influence a single or a couple organizations can have if they do put millions at it. So you have a system that could negatively impact the country. So hundreds of millions of people, especially in our industry. And it driven by a couple private organizations, which you know, brings the millions of dollars to bear, can do the lobbying efforts. So I think it kind of highlights, I don't want to call it, well, maybe it is a broken system, but I think the dangers of that whole lobbying realm. And, you know, we've had to jump in a little bit. Obviously we don't have the budget. Obviously we can't put and match spend like that, but fortunately I think our side is a little bit easier. We just need to educate folks. We need to get in front of them. We need to say like, hey, here's the scenario. What's being proposed is private ownership of the law. And like, do you think that makes sense in a democracy and for things like the construction industry? And we've had to go in front of senators and the different offices just simply to educate them. Be like, hey, here's what's at stake. And this would be the downstream implication if something like this got pushed through.
So are you guys doing that on your own? Or are you partnering with some of the others that have been trying to, you know, you weren't the only plaintiff, so others have been involved in this and, you know, one that made it to the Supreme Court wasn't even you guys. So are you partnering? How are you? Because it is a huge fight to educate that. And to say our system is broken, you're not wrong. It's broken. I mean, it is, and it's foundationally broken. It's driven by money. It's not driven by logic. There's a number of different things that we could talk about. And it could really negatively impact, but that doesn't seem to have the effect it needs to. So who are you partnering with? And are there other things that people can do beyond what you guys are doing to make this problem known?
Yeah. So I wouldn't say formally partnering with anybody, but there are a lot of people involved opposing this. And interestingly, they don't need to be, you know, the victim of litigation to get involved and know what's at stake here. But people like the American Library Association or the ALA, the Association of Research Libraries, the American Foundation for the Blind, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Wikimedia Foundation. So many people that would be negatively impacted by constricting access to laws. And like I mentioned, like pull up the name here, but the American Foundation for the Blind. Now, there someone like that would be concerned because if you limit access and you limit the way people can read the code through, let's say, like a hamstrung reading room, it could be very difficult for someone who, you know, doesn't have sight to actually read the codes and use a digital e-reader to actually read them out loud. And that's what's being proposed here is a very kind of locked down reading room to actually see the codes. Or the Electronic Frontier Foundation that always, you know, advocates for open access to information and in this case, especially law. So there are a lot of parties that have kind of shown up in a really nice way to like as mentioned before, just educate a lot of these folks in DC.
Well, and even just Googling, I found one here, the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Resource Coalition, SPARC, is a nonprofit international that, yeah, has this whole article on opposing the, you know, quote, pro-codes act. Because it's true, even like the name itself is very deceptive, right, in its nature.
Exactly. And that's the design. And that goes back to the topic of education and why we have to get in front of these offices is because it is like a wolf in sheep's clothing. Like it is very much designed to look innocuous, to look very innocent. And it's very confusing in the writing. And when we talk to some of these offices, they are confused. They say like, oh, I thought this bill proposed something else. I thought it was like actually advancing open access. And it's like, no. This is locking down open access. This is giving private ownership of the law. So I think like Spark and others are doing a really good job just putting a spotlight on it and saying, hey, this has national implications. This is a really, really contentious and dangerous bill.
Man, I'm hearing a lot of parallels to the international BIM standards efforts. And I think there's a lot of controversy kind of, because that's just the nature of kind of the old way you always did it and the new way we need to do it. And there's this natural turmoil that's occurring. And I think we can all learn from each other in these different verticals.
There's so many opportunities to innovate, but yeah, Nathan, you're exactly right. It's people who might be holding on to like an old way of doing things. And they're like, hey, I don't want to reinvent the way we've done it. Like it's worked for me in the past. Let's just keep going forward. But I think innovation needs to kind of constantly reinvent the way we think about things, the workflows, and eventually get us to a place where it's a lot easier to do our job than it was in the past.
Well, and that's what I wanted to say, Scott, is bringing you on here and raising awareness to this, because I want all our other folks out there, our BIM and VDC, to understand that if this is limited, it's a foundational aspect to the way that we design and we build and we construct and then we inspect. So this is a fundamental component that if locked away is going to severely limit the amount of innovation and change and access that we can have in an environment where we don't have enough skilled trades. We don't have enough people to do this work. We are losing millions of dollars in the process of building things incorrectly or against code, having rework, having all these problems. And we're investing all of this money in innovation. And we're fundamentally going to be limited in our output if this law or this bill grants private access and privatizes the law around those building codes. And we need everybody listening to realize that at some point you're going to ask why a tool can't do something. And it could come all the way back to, sorry, but Pro Codes Act made it through and we can't do that.
I was exactly going to say the same thing, because every Construction Dorks episode, when, you know, somebody's howling at the moon of like, why can't I do this? Why can't I? And it's all these griping, and it's, well, no, the reason why is further upstream, these things are happening, and it's not allowing us to do this potential that we see. And that's why we have so much pent up frustration and burnout, is that we see this potential of what we can do, and we don't actually understand all the reasons upstream why we can't do what we see as possible. And that's very disheartening. Like, at least I've been able to see everything that's going on, and I've built more resilience and patience, whatever I think all of us have over time. But yeah, if you don't know all of those things, it can be really, really frustrating to be in this business.
Yeah. And so many of those pain points, exactly like you're saying, is it comes from upstream things, and it's very abstract or opaque, and you wouldn't realize it, right? Like, you might be in a product or a software and doing something, you're like, yeah, I mean, just like you're saying, like, why can't it do that? And it turns out, you know, years ago or maybe ongoing, there's all these dynamics in the background that are actually limiting that. And like, maybe the provider wanted to give that to you, but their hands were tied and they couldn't.
Yeah. And they wanted to build it into their product, or they wanted to teach it through integration with the products themselves. There's so many digital tools to build with these days that, if enabled with, you know, democratized access to this information, can do a lot of the checking, a lot of the checks and balances, can alert people along the way and let people, you know, build faster. And we just don't do that well enough right now.
I mean, you have the famous McKinsey study. I don't know if you've covered this before, but it's been mentioned a lot. But, you know, they did the study, and over 50 years, the construction industry has decreased in productivity compared against agriculture and a lot of other industries, which have increased in productivity. And you got to wonder why. I mean, and they did, you know, they obviously did a deep dive there. But it's the aggregation of so many of these friction points that have not let us see that gain in productivity.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because I'm an interesting on the fence one. I'm kind of tired of the McKinsey report, because there are so many of these reasons why we've been held back as an industry from reaching our potential. And again, we're here sitting here talking about one that has gone through its legal hurdles and is now back and being backdoored again. And whether you agree with it or not, we haven't reached our capabilities and the level of productivity we could get to, because we're being held back.
And I will mention, one of the really helpful things, and even when we were in DC talking to some of these offices, is hearing from individuals. And people had reached out to the representatives or to their senators and said, like, hey, this is something that impacts my life. This is bringing friction to me. And it'll have an immediate impact, and it'll have a future impact. And people have reached out in a really meaningful way. And I think it really has started to sway the conversation in a really good way. I know EFF had a site where you could, if you put EFF ProCodes Act or UpCodes ProCodes Act into Google, it pops up. But it's just a way you can find out who the representatives are and just let them know of those friction points. It's like, hey, this is what my day-to-day looks like. And it'd be, you know, made even more challenging if we didn't have access to some of these tools.
Yeah. And that's what our general contractors, that's what our trade contractors, that's what our designers that listen in can do right now. You can go in and go to those sites, put it in, find out. And that is the one cool part of this, is they can spend millions of dollars, but if we raise our voices, you know, that's how this is supposed to work, is that we can raise our voices and we can compete with that through education and through saying, hey, this is, you know, this is going to negatively impact the way we build and what we can deliver from an infrastructure building. And, you know, look, we have a housing crisis. We have a number of crises. This act will add to that.
Yeah. It's ironic, because instead of spending your time building, you know, more efficient, you know, programs for helping codes, we have to build ways to calculate gray work, our new favorite term for this redundant work that we do, and to be able to show, like, hey, this is the gray work that this ProCodes Act is creating, or the way, you know, this hidden waste. Because if we don't show that, then we can't convince people to change. And it's like, yeah, we keep spending too much time doing that than actually solving problems.
Yeah, I will say one of the really refreshing things in, you know, hearing back from the visit to DC is that while there are organizations putting millions of dollars to you know, promote and try and push this bill through, a lot of these offices, the senator's offices, had heard from individuals, and it really resonates. You know, these are people that vote them into office, and at the end of the day, they do represent them, but they do need to hear from them. And It was fascinating talking to them, being like, yeah, we spoke to this GC, we spoke to this builder or this architect in our constituency, and they kind of walked us through like how many downstream bad implications this could have. And I think it just brings a really nice reality, like a tangible reality to these offices. And at the end of the day, like that is who they're supposed to be representing. And I think it was refreshing to hear how much they actually cared. Like they really did listen to it, and they're speaking these points back, and they clearly got it. Now we just need to make sure enough people, you know, like enough of these offices are actually hear those voices.
Well, and that's it's truly, you know, to the point of this is that the system is built in such a way that a lot of these things are recommended. And then it is all up to us to say, hey, no, like you need to learn what's going on. And I think, you know, we have a number of organizations at the national level that spend time lobbying, that understand this stuff and understand that the need to access it and to have the voices heard, that can go out and get those constituents to talk a little bit about it and say, listen, how does a senator or a congressman know that, you know, how this is going to negatively impact unless they're educated on it? There's tons of these things going on. So it's awesome to see that. And that's where I wanted to take it, like at the final, like let's say everybody, and by the way, everybody go out there and make sure, you know, you go to the sites, and we'll make sure it's available when the episode's out for everybody to find the link. But if we can get past this hurdle, what are the types of things that, you know, UpCodes could go back and really dig into and get to the transformation? So, you know, what is this holding us back from is what I wanted to get at.
Yeah. And I'll go back to something Nathan mentioned around the, you know, the gray work and, or let's say like rework. And I think the potential for tools is to capture as many code mistakes as possible upstream in the process before they even become a problem. Like we think about permitting being a huge friction point, plan review is difficult for both sides of, you know, of the table, the plan reviewer, but also that the application into the construction side and then into inspection. There's so many friction points there that originate upstream simply because it's so difficult to understand what is the code and then track it all the way through. So we're working on an AI system that can identify that as much as possible, understanding what are you working on? Okay, is it multifamily residential in this state and you want to do this construction type? What are the codes you got to follow? Proactively, you know, going through and being like, hey, you may have missed this section and you should really consider, you know, looking at this side or design trade-offs, like making more efficient buildings, whether it's, you know, speed or cost or safety, just optimizing a little bit better, where instead of this very analog manual process, you're starting to automate more of it so you can iterate faster and more reliably through that. Now, we want to do that upstream, you know, on the design side, but it's important on the build side. You know, so if there's last minute decisions, you're swapping out an assembly, you're swapping out a material, is that material compliant? When you look at the installation guide, like, is this, you know, does it pair or does it match? And what's the overall impact on the building's performance? Very hard to answer that, you know, on the spot today. But I think getting the data there, building the systems, and especially with a lot of the AI developments, gets us to that point where we can answer those questions very reliably and very quickly on the spot.
Man, you just got my head going about, yeah, not just managing compliance of the code, but actually suggesting alternatives potentially. Or looking at, yeah, ways to actually optimize or improve, yeah, sustainability. That's crazy.
We're seeing advancements in materials. And so I've talked to a couple advanced material groups, and they've come up against friction of whether or not it fits, you know, with the codes, whether or not it's compliant, especially when it's, you know, not been spec'd in originally. And then it's an opportunity where they can be more efficient, also reduce their carbon footprint. But they don't do it because they're not sure. And so this, I see it opening up material opportunities, you know, opportunities for new materials that can get code compliant and then be used to swap out.
And that's actually exactly what we're working on. So that is the roadmap. So tying together the world of regulation codes with assemblies, and then products. So looking at EPDs, looking at the performance metrics, and does it match code, and what are the options for you and your building? And we've heard it so many times, and it's such a shame, but designers or on the build side, considering a new product, and that product might reduce the carbon footprint, it might have better performance metrics, and it really is a better product for that project. Like, they should really be using that, but they can't because they're not sure if it's compliant. They don't know if it works. And to traverse that, to get that answer is so, so difficult today. So I don't blame them, but they use an old product. They use the one from a couple of years ago, not as performative, bigger carbon footprint. And it's a shame.
But it's safe. Yeah, it's a safe bet. And right. We understand why they do, but it doesn't make it right.
Yeah, we're reducing risk. So basically, ultimately, democratizing access to these codes can really create a foundation for innovation in materials, whether that's carbon, whether that's constructability, compliance. So we really want everyone listening to lean into, if we want to maintain, our ability to innovate, we've got to maintain our access to the information and the codes that exist out there. That's why we need them to get involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just add, like, those are the things we're thinking of, but who knows what other people are thinking of. And there's going to be all these different workflows that get queued up, a platform that people will build on and really, really, really run with it. So, I think we mentioned a couple today, but who knows what other people could work on.
Well, that's the beauty, right? We don't know what we don't know. So, but we won't have the opportunity to get there if we have to fight even harder just to get access to it.
Right.
Scott, where can people go that want to learn more about this, and then maybe highlight those sites as well that they can go get involved?
Yeah. So our main site is UpCodes. So it's up.codes for the main site. And then the ProCodes Act is up.codes/ProCodes Act, and each word separated by a dash. But of course, you can just throw it into Google and it'll lead you right there.
Awesome. Well, listen, it is awesome. I think we timed this right to get you on the show. We've been excited to watch you the whole time, and we're excited to bring you along for the Construction Technology News of the Week. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built. All right, Nathan, what do you got now for me?
I found a couple special ones for Scott. So I'm going to be selfish on this one. This first one I found in the Denver Gazette. So Denver Mayor Mike Johnson claimed city exceeded goal to reduce permitting time by 30%. So I learned that I was so lucky enough in my home renovation here a couple years ago that I fell into the longest case. So 12 to 15 weeks for a permit response time is as high as it got for Denver. And in all, through the different views, it was 5 days short of a year for me to get just a basic residential addition permit reviewed. It was crazy in 2022, but they thankfully have gotten that reduced at least by 33% again for the homes and duplexes. Large apartment complexes are down by 11%. And the mayor says, credits a tiger team that uses intermediate commercial projects. It is combining previous efforts with, current innovations and initiatives. So I am curious to learn more about what some of those current innovations and initiatives that help them save that, other than just throwing more people at it. Because I do know, I will give credit to City of Denver. They do have a fairly sophisticated, I think Acela is their system of choice. And I remember as I was uploading those drawings, you could see they were uploading into the Bluebeam Studio. So they're doing something with Bluebeam Studio in their review, which was cool. But I don't know, Scott, if you guys are doing anything with City of Denver, can provide any insights on what they're doing to maybe speed up that process and make it faster.
Yeah, and I will say, I know there's a lot of friction and frustration with permitting times. Like everyone's felt that pain before. We do have a little bit of a soft spot for the planning, the buildings department. We work with a lot of them. So we work with designers, we work with builders, but a lot of governments across the country. And it's a hard job. It's really, really difficult. And it's not by lack of trying for these delayed permitting process. It's just the difficulty of the job and ties in to everything we just mentioned. It's like getting more and more of these tools. So I can't speak to Denver specifically, but what we have seen in other departments is bringing on tools. So like, let's say it's permitting or it's a backend system to manage the applications or plan review or inspection, or ourselves with upcodes to learn, use AI that they can rapidly get through to the code and then send it out to the architect. So we've seen more and more adoption of these tools, and I think it's making an impact. Now, I would love if it was not just a 33 or an 11% increase or decrease, I should say. Right. I'd love if that was more like 90 or 95, but I think, you know, at least we're trending in the right direction in a lot of the cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's critical. We haven't reached the numbers we'd like to see, but the fact that we are moving in the right direction and moving to digital tools. And like you said, Scott, part of this is to have a respect for a lot of the times, you know, the permit offices and whatnot take a lot of the flack, and understand that the reason we got here is because a lot of people got things through that were dangerous. And we're really trying to prevent that, right? And so again, there's a risk there to the city that they're going to allow someone to build something that's going to be structurally unsound or not safe or that isn't built the way, you know, we need. It's going to put people at risk. So there's risk on both sides. So there is no, it's not about throwing stones. It's about opening up the difficulty and the friction points, like you said, so that we can let people do what they're really good at, identify the problems, report those back, have them adjusted and fixed. Because again, like you said, these aren't straightforward things that are just like, oh, everybody can understand them. There's thousands of them and they're extensive. So it's great to have a respect for that and to see that there's probably a number of different areas of the tools. Like you said, the application process, the analysis, the initial analysis, some of the feedback mechanisms, right? Right now, they're in a lot of places, they were archaic and it's time to upgrade them.
Well, I will give them credit. They were very thorough because again, that's with time comes thoroughness. Now I think again, Scott, what you're working on is, can we get that same thoroughness with less time? Right. That would be the holy grail.
And I think you want to bring transparency and consistency to the process. Mm-hmm. So you never want to get to the permitting stage and then be shocked or surprised by something. But of course, that happens all the time today. But it's really a shame because ideally you get to that process and you know there's predictability and you know what the potential problems are or have the tools that could actually check before you even, you know, get to the plan reviewer's counter. And then so you get there and there's going to be no surprises. Maybe you want to talk about, you know, an exception or something like that, get into the nitty gritty, but never should you be surprised or blindsided by something.
Yeah, I would love to see an analysis of time spent by the inspector on said review and then the amount of time it took to return it. Because really the measurable mm-hmm. should be, can we reduce the amount of human interaction necessary to get the same level of validation on a permitted design. So yeah, I digress. But let's keep it on the permitting one, because I found another one here, Silicon Hills News. So Greenlight, a startup in the permitting space, has just raised $28.5 million in their Series A to streamline construction permitting with tech-driven solutions. So again, they are looking at, I think their platform again is integrating construction plans, zoning data, local building codes, and expert compliance reviews into that single system, looking to help developers and governments streamline and modernize construction permitting process. So very similar to what you see, you know, Procore and others for GCs, it looks like Greenlight, I think, for the developer and government program is trying to do that. And it sounds like, Scott, you're familiar with Greenlight. You guys are either partnering with them or they're in your space. Is that right?
Yeah, so we know the team, and I think it's such a good ambition and a good product. I mean, it's solving some of these pain points exactly like we're talking about, that friction in permitting, just getting dedicated teams, you know, and funding. That's amazing to see the funding mm-hmm. come in. Historically, VC is not, you know, channeled a lot into construction, so it's nice to see more and more of that come in. But it's exactly that, like trying to get more innovation, more solutions dedicated to these pain points, and just trying to eradicate a lot of the pain points.
Yeah, I think I saw Permit Flow and maybe Pulley might be another one. So yeah, I think it's I mean, good for that segment, maybe not good for them as competitors in the same space, but good to see that area is, there's a hotbed there for kind of the permit tech space. Cause it's one that we were talking about that stuff in 2017, 2018, Jeff. It's cool to see that it seems to be making a good resurgence.
Yeah, it's really great to see. And I mean, just so people listening in get an idea, is that the statement of Greenlight CEO, across the US, there are 20,000 jurisdictions with over 500,000 different forms and processes for building permits, but 95% of the applicable building code is the same. So while there's a giant opportunity and giant space, it's actually 95% the same. So there's this huge opportunity to streamline and get rid of friction and allow us to, to really work faster, but probably to a better outcome in the end too. That's the key here, is we want to get to these better outcomes.
And I think this whole idea of plug and play, right? Like 95% of it is the same, but the way it's applied in the situation and that, like that, Scott, that's where it gets really complex, right?
Exactly. And there is room for interpretation. So it is really tricky. Like 95% of the underlying code might be the same, but how do you apply it?
Yeah. I was going to ask if you agree with that statement or not.
Well, I think it's true. It's like factually accurate. I think a lot of the friction points is, just how do you interpret it? And I was just talking to someone who, was installing fire alarm systems, and they were hitting the required decibel, level to the code, but the fire marshal wanted higher. They wanted 9 to 9 decibels, and it's not in the code, but they have the ability to raise the bar, and they did. And I think that's a part of the tricky, like that last mile to get it across the line. Like there is interpretation, or people interpret it into.
But how do you at least flag that into a platform, almost like Nextdoor, right? Of like, hey, by the way, like code may be here, but you never know. If you get this inspector, he may raise it up to here. So at least others can be aware of it and prepare for it maybe.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I guess firms build up that institutional knowledge over time. They're like, hey, we've worked in this jurisdiction. We've worked with this department, and maybe even individuals in that department. And they can compare notes and say like, this thing may be a little bit easier to get through, this thing that we had surprises. And so I think there is a lot of institutional knowledge. But again, silo data, knowledge.
Because now it's intellectual property, right? Or so we think. So that's the next battle, right? All right, Jeff, what do you got?
Well, I'm going to stay on the controversy. Might as well today. But we're going to get off of building codes, and we're going to go into some – and I'm going to play both sides against the middle here just for fun. So if you are not aware, Amazon has released a new office-only work policy. And there is a lot of competing thoughts on it. If you search it right now, you'll find, the one article I have, Amazon's new office only work policy is sure to backfire. However, on another side, Amazon's return to office mandate could boost downtown Seattle's recovery. So there is a lot going on about this, the hybrid work, the in-office work, and sort of the reasons why we're pushing people back, or large corporations are pushing people back to the office. And it's not as clear cut as maybe it seems. I'd love to jump on one side or the other completely, and it's this or it's that, but it's pretty nuanced in the way that it works and where you work and how you work. So, and there was some material impact to our cities and our infrastructures. So, what is the right answer? I don't know what the right answer is, but I brought up both these articles because I wanted to talk a little bit about how, there's been analysis of traffic patterns. And there's also, some of the folks that are going back to the, 2-3 days in the office, are they really going back for 2 to 3 full days, or is it really the best use? So I just wanted to put this in there to bring up the push. I can't imagine a 5-day back is a good idea. And I imagine this is going to have a big ripple impact for Amazon, and they're going to have to then react to that on the other side. That's their, it's their business. They can do what they want. I'm sure the city of Seattle wants to see this. So I wanted to go and just kind of put this out here so we could talk a little bit openly about what we're seeing as pretty heavy pressure, by the way, across industry to go back to the office on full days, not, you know, when needed, so to speak.
Yeah, I have to question the motives of like, okay, yeah, what really is the reason? Because there are a lot of reasons why you would or would not want to do this. And I can only imagine, yeah, what is going through Andy Jassy's head in making this decision. Because, yeah, he knows the ripple effects it's going to have. And, yeah, maybe that's intentional. Who knows?
Right? You never know. Scott, I'm interested because, you know, we talked in the pre-show, you're fully remote and it seems to work for you guys. So what about the thoughts on these large companies and Amazon itself making this kind of push?
Yeah. So I'm obviously, I'm going to be a little bit biased here. So we were in person fully, during or before the pandemic. And then during the pandemic went remote with the intention to come back in person, but it works so well being remote. We just embraced it. We started recruiting, remote and we're fully remote. Distributed team today. Now, some people are in the same cities and we'll meet up and we'll do different things like that. But I am firmly in the camp of remote. And I think, especially for these types of jobs, it's you can really measure the output. And I think you recruit people, you recruit talent. And I think you want to measure by their contribution to the product, the contribution to the projects, and the work output versus the time in seat or like filling, you know, butts in seats. Now, I know that it kind of cuts a little bit both ways. Like, how do you really know people are doing work? And I just think it puts a lot of onus on kind of measuring output and, you know, setting up some KPIs. And it does take a level of maturity, like individuals, you know, fully flexible work hours. Maybe they do like a workout class in the middle of the workday, but they got to work a little bit later. It's a little bit tough and it takes a huge amount of maturity and self-starting and motivation. I think it works for some people. I think it's pretty challenging for other people, but you know, we're firmly in the remote camp.
Yeah. Well, and I like that you bring it up because there's a level of individual maturity. There's a level of organizational maturity and there's a level of business necessity and interaction, right? There are a lot of processes that are proven to be far better in person than they are remote. But the vice is actually versa. And that's what the hybrid environment has really showed us is that there are certain jobs that if measured correctly can be far more productive because they require flow and large chunks of not being interrupted. And quite frankly, a lot of that's hard to get during a day, you know, on a set schedule versus a flexible schedule where you can, you know, drop your kids off at school and know that they don't have to be picked up until X. You don't have to then commute into the office. You don't have to then be interrupted at the water cooler or whatever it might be. You get them to school and you get in and you dig in and you get 2-3-4 hour chunks of, you know, you shouldn't work for 2-3-4 hours straight, but you can take breaks in there and keep going to get really focused work done. And a lot of companies are looking at like, you know, Wednesday policy of no meetings and encouraging hybrid work for those folks. And then there's the, hey, let's be intentional when we get together. And my other least favorite thing is to, okay, we're going to get together for the purpose of getting together. Like, yes, if you're celebrating and you want your teams to just have some social interaction, that's actually a purpose. Like, hey, we're going to get the teams together and we want you to just interact a little bit. But hey, I'm going to have you come to the office because you should be in the office. Like, no, have a purpose. Like, I have this group together. We have this project we're going to work on. And we're really looking for ideas and input and a good session around X, Y, or Z. On the flip, I also think it's an opportunity when you're fully remote for culture to get out of hand. And it is really easy to hide interactions over Zoom that are, you know, reading body language, you know, reading tone. All of that is very different when people are in person. And there's a need for some of that. But again, Scott, that goes to your point of the maturity levels of the organization and the KPIs and your ability to measure what people are doing.
But I agree so much. Like when you mentioned it's dependent on the company and the individual, there's also the concept of the role. Like what's the actual nature of your job? And I think even looking at our team, there's different roles are impacted in different ways. Some are a little bit maybe handicapped and some are benefited in a really nice way. So on the one hand, on product and design, you miss out on the whiteboarding. And it's really hard to recreate that remote. And you get Zoom fatigue, very real thing. No one wants to be on Zoom all day. And whiteboarding collaboration sessions just are, you know, they're just going to be a little bit constrained and not as productive when you're not in person. But on the flip side, on the software engineering side, they need those long stretches of flow. Like they're just working on writing software code. And not only are we remote, we're asynchronous, meaning we try to do as much communication in a written form versus live meetings. And you can have engineers that have one or two meetings per week. And that there's so little structure to the workday. So it really, you have to be mature. You have to be self-starting just to take a full week. And there's only two kind of like rocks in your schedule, right? And it might be on a Monday, it might be on a Friday. And what are you going to do with those other days? But like you're being measured on the output and the KPIs, but you got to be structured and you got to be disciplined.
Yeah, I want to put that in the terms of like BIM, VDC, detailing, those kinds of things. This is like, you know, those activities where you're drawing in Revit and you're doing things digitally, that's the same thing as if time on the keyboard, you know, doing your coding. So, but those have very specific deliverables and they're in many cases better off, you know, in some sort of flow state. Some of those get that flow state in an office, some do not. And so there's an opportunity there to do that versus the ones who we want on a job site, in the trailer, you know, we want them working and having eyes on things. So again, it's all about the job. Nathan, I'm interested then I'm going to take us to another piece of extension of this.
No, following on that, I mean, even the coordination meeting is a great example of something that I think you do want to be in person because it can get a little bit boring if you're sitting on a Zoom and they can get a little bit long, but when you've got everyone in the room and you're really cognizant of who's in the room and you're respectful of their time, you can get a lot of stuff knocked out really quick. So people have their action items, they go back to work and go off and can keep doing their detailing. So yeah, I think there's absolutely a rhythm or a sprint that these different activities go through, that some things are best done in person and others are best done remote.
So with that, I'm going to pivot us into PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC tells UK staff it will monitor office attendance in order to be compliant with their 3 days a week, either in the office or with clients. So we've just discussed all the positive and negative of hybrid environment. So leaving that behind and putting your geek hat on here for a second, this is wild to what kind of technology you're going to need to monitor this. They have 26,000 UK employees. I mean, we struggle to manage 1,000 people on a job site and know where everybody is and who showed up and who's badged in and badged out. Just geek out for a second, Nathan, on how do you manage this?
I mean, badges, right? Like the same way you get into a big building. I mean, you badge and you badge out. I've been on the big jobs with the thousands of craft workers, and yeah, it looks almost like a jail, but but you got your little RFID badge and you get badged in and out, and it tracks. I mean, I can't imagine how you would do that before the age of RFID tagging and stuff like that. But it, you know, to me, that it's crappy that, you know, more of the fact that they have to, you know, we can talk about their need to monitor the attendance, but as far as the logistical battle of it, I actually, you know, if we're talking about office employees, I don't think it's that challenging anymore.
Well, it's interesting because it says the firm said the new policy was designed to formalize our approach to working together in person. And it again, interesting though, in, you know, how do you monitor whether you're at client sites enough? This brings into the technology fold some interesting questions as to how that's going to be managed and protected as well. This is UK, right? So this is, you know, there's a lot of rules. Scott, I'm interested in this side of things from your perspective.
Yeah, well, it just seems they're measuring the wrong thing, right? They're measuring, when did you come into the building? And they're, you know, from the technical standpoint, they're putting energy, they're putting time and sophistication into, you know, this measurement system. But all they need to worry about is if they're delivering a good product to the client. Measure that. Like, why are we measuring people in and out of a building with all this time and energy? Just at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is your work output and what you're giving to the clients, and are they happy with it? So it just seems a whole lot of energy put into completely the wrong place in my perspective.
I like that. I like that because it's like I'm measuring a lot, but really, am I measuring what matters?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
And I could probably create a system that measures that output and put just as much effort into it and get a lot more return.
I mean, you said measure what matters. That's the name of the book from, I think Andy Grove, but where they introduced mm-hmm. KPIs. So nailed it.
Yeah. You got to measure what matters. Well, it has been fantastic to have you join us for the news and for the interview, Scott. And it was a long time coming, and I'm always excited to have somebody who is a true fan, but also is creating some of that news themselves.
Yeah. So good to be on the show. I've, again, longtime listener. It's just exciting to partake in it and be on the other side.
Nathan, it's always great to sit down with you and talk some controversy.
Man, this was fun. Let's do it again soon.
And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Scott Reynolds. To read all our news stories, to learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is The Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.